File 40.
Chapter 7. The Revolution. In 1915, the enemy started his propaganda among our soldiers. From 1916 onwards, it steadily became more intensive, and at the beginning of 1918, it had swollen into a storm flood. One could now judge the effects of this proselytizing movement step by step. Gradually, our soldiers began to think just in the way the enemy wished them to think. On the German side, there was no counter-propaganda. At that time, the army authorities, under our able and resolute commander, were willing and ready to take up the fight in the propaganda domain also, but unfortunately, they did not have the necessary means to carry that intention into effect. Moreover, the army authorities would have made a psychological mistake had they undertaken the task of mental training. To be efficacious, it had come from the home front. For only thus could it be successful among men who, for nearly 4 years now, had been performing immortal deeds of heroism and undergoing all sorts of privations for the sake of that home. But what were the people at home doing? Was their failure to act merely due to unintelligence or bad faith? In the midsummer of 1918, after the evacuation of the southern bank of the Herne, the German press adopted a policy which was so woefully inopportune, and even criminally stupid, that I used to ask myself a question which made me more and more furious day after day. Is it really true that we have nobody who will dare to put an end to this process of spiritual sabotage, which is being carried on amongst our heroic troops? What happened in France during those days of 1914, when our armies invaded that country and were marching in triumph from one victory to another? What happened in Italy, when their armies collapsed on the Isonzo front? What happened in France again during the spring of 1918, when the German divisions took the main French positions by storm, and heavy long-distance artillery bombarded Paris? How they whipped up the flagging courage of those troops who were retreating and fanned the fires of national enthusiasm among them! How their propaganda and their marvellous aptitude in the exercise of mass influence reawakened the fighting spirit in that broken front and hammered into the heads of the soldiers a firm belief in final victory. Meanwhile, what were our people doing in this sphere? Nothing, or even worse than nothing. Again and again I used to become enraged and indignant as I read the latest papers and realized the nature of the mass murder they were committing through their influence on the minds of the people and the soldiers. More than once I was tormented by the thought that if Providence had put the conduct of German propaganda into my hands, instead of into the hands of those incompetent and even criminal ignoramuses and weaklings, the outcome of the struggle might have been different. During those months, I felt for the first time that fate was dealing adversely with me and keeping me on the fighting front, and in a position where any chance bullet from some nigger or other might finish me, whereas I could have done the fatherland a real service in another sphere. For I was then presumptuous enough to believe that I would have been successful in managing the propaganda business. But I was a being without a name, one among 8 millions. Hence it was better for me to keep my mouth shut and do my duty as well as I could in the position to which I had been assigned. in the summer of 1915, the first enemy leaflets were dropped on our trenches. They all told more or less the same story, with some variations in the form of it. The story was that distress was steadily on the increase in Germany, that the war would last indefinitely, that the prospect of victory for us was becoming fainter day after day, that the people at home were yearning for peace, but that militarism and the Kaiser would not permit it, that the world, which knew this very well, was not waging war against the German people, but only against the man who was exclusively responsible, the Kaiser, that until this enemy of world peace was removed, there could be no end to the conflict, but that when the war was over, the liberal and democratic nations would receive the Germans as colleagues in the League for World Peace. This would be done the moment the Prussian militarism had been finally destroyed. To illustrate and substantiate all these statements, the leaflets very often contained letters from home, the contents of which appeared to confirm the enemy's propagandist message. Generally speaking, we only laughed at all these efforts. The leaflets were read, sent to base headquarters, then forgotten, until a favourable wind once again blew a fresh contingent into the trenches. These were mostly dropped from aeroplanes, which were used specially for that purpose. One feature of this propaganda was very striking. It was that in sections where Bavarian troops were stationed, every effort was made by the enemy propagandists to stir up feeling against the Prussians, assuring the soldiers that Prussia and Prussia alone was the guilty party who was responsible for bringing on and continuing the war, and that there was no hostility whatsoever towards the Bavarians, but that there could be no possibility of coming to their assistance so long as they continued to serve Prussian interests and help to pull the Prussian chestnuts out of the fire. This persistent propaganda began to have a real influence on our soldiers in 1915. The feeling against Prussia grew quite noticeable among the Bavarian troops, but those in authority did nothing to counteract it. This was something more than a mere crime of omission, for sooner or later not only the Prussians were bound to have to atone severely for it, but the whole German nation, and consequently the Bavarians themselves also. In this direction, the enemy propaganda began to achieve undoubted success from 1916 onwards. In a similar way, letters coming directly from home had long since been exercising their effect. There was now no further necessity for the enemy to broadcast such letters in leaflet form, and also, against this influence from home, nothing was done except a few supremely stupid warnings uttered by the executive government. The whole front was drenched in this poison which thoughtless women at home sent out without suspecting for a moment that the enemy's chances of final victory were thus strengthened, or that the sufferings of their own men at the front were thus being prolonged and rendered more severe. These stupid letters written by German women eventually cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of our men. Thus, in 1916, several distressing phenomena were already manifest. The whole front was complaining and grousing, discontented over many things, and often justifiably so. While they were hungry and yet patient, and their relatives at home were in distress, in other quarters there was feasting and revelry. Yes, even on the front itself, everything was not as it ought to have been in this regard. Even in the early stages of the war, the soldiers were sometimes prone to complain, but such criticism was confined to internal affairs. The man who at one moment groused and grumbled ceased his murmur after a few moments and went about his duty silently, as if everything were in order. The company, which had given signs of discontent a moment earlier, hung on now to its bit of trench, defending it tooth and nail, as if Germany's fate depended on these few hundred yards of mud and shell holes. The glorious old army was still at its post. A sudden change in my own fortunes soon placed me in a position where I had first-hand experience of the contrast between this old army and the home front. At the end of September 1916, my division was sent into the Battle of the Somme. For us, this was the first of a series of heavy engagements, and the impression created was that of a veritable inferno rather than war. Through weeks of incessant artillery bombardment we stood firm, at times ceding a little ground, but then taking it back again, and never giving way. On October the 7th, 1916, I was wounded, but had the luck of being able to get back to our lines, and was then ordered to be sent by ambulance train to Germany. 2 years had passed since I had left home, an almost endless period in such circumstances. I could hardly imagine what Germans looked like without uniforms. In the clearing hospital at Hermias, I was startled when I suddenly heard the voice of a German woman who was acting as nursing sister and talking with one of the wounded men lying near me. 2 years! And then this voice for the first time. The nearer our ambulance train approached the German frontier, the more restless each one of us became. En route, we recognized all these places through which we passed 2 years before as young volunteers. Brussels, Louvain, Liège, and finally, we thought we recognized the first German homestead, with its familiar high gables and picturesque window shutters. Home. What a change! From the mud of the Somme battlefields to the spotless white beds in this wonderful building. One hesitated at first before entering them. It was only by slow stages that one could grow accustomed to this new world again. But unfortunately, there were certain other aspects also in which this new world was different. The spirit of the army at the front appeared to be out of place here. For the first time, I encountered something which up to then was unknown at the front, namely, boasting of one's own cowardice. For though we certainly heard complaining and grousing at the front, this was never in the spirit of any agitation to insubordination, and certainly not an attempt to glorify one's fear. No, there at the front, a coward was a coward and nothing else, and the contempt which his weakness aroused in the others was quite general, just as the real hero was admired all round. But here, in hospital, the spirit was quite different in some respects. Loud-mouthed agitators were busy here in heaping ridicule on the good soldier and painting the weak-kneed poltroon in glorious colours. A couple of miserable human specimens were the ringleaders in this process of defamation. One of them boasted of having intentionally injured his hand in barbed wire entanglements in order to get sent to hospital. Although his wound was only a slight one, it appeared that he had been here for a very long time and would be here interminably. Some arrangement for him seemed to be worked by some sort of swindle, just as he got sent here in the ambulance train through a swindle. This pestilential specimen actually had the audacity to parade his knavery as the manifestation of a courage which was superior to that of the brave soldier who dies a hero's death. There were many who heard this talk in silence, but there were others who expressed their assent to what the fellow said. Personally, I was disgusted at the thought that a seditious agitator of this kind should be allowed to remain in such an institution. What could be done? The hospital authorities here must have known who and what he was, and actually they did know. But still they did nothing about it. As soon as I was able to walk once again, I obtained leave to visit Berlin. Bitter want was in evidence everywhere. The metropolis, with its teeming millions, was suffering from hunger. The talk that was current in the various places of refreshment and hospices visited by the soldiers was much the same as that in our hospital. The impression given was that these agitators purposely singled out such places in order to spread their views. But in Munich, conditions were far worse.